This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Jeremy Brecker about a new book of his called Against Doom, a Climate Insurgency Manual. And those who know me know this is a subject that I'm deeply interested in and committed to. So I'm really happy to be talking to you today, Jeremy. How are you?
Good. Sitting here in the middle of a thunderstorm, which severe weather is certainly one of the things that we know is coming along with climate change. So perhaps that's appropriate. It'll certainly raise my consciousness as I'm involved in this discussion.
Right. Especially if there's a flood, you know, or some biblical event, then we'll know, you know, those every 100-year events that happen every other year now. This book, you know, I think there are lots of people writing about ways of dealing with climate change. And I think you acknowledge very early in this book, and I will preface by saying, for anyone who's listening, this is a very short and practical book with a lot of information. I really recommend getting a copy of this book if you're looking for practical ideas and a certain amount of optimism about how individual people can band together to make change. That's what this book is about. But you talk about something I think is really important in this book, and maybe you could talk about it a little bit here, and that is this notion of despair. You quote the percentages of people that believe in climate change, vast majority of Americans, who believe that change needs to occur, vast majority of Americans, but who don't somehow believe that change will happen. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the background of how it is that so many people who are so engaged feel so hopeless.
Well, I think there are really two aspects of it. One is climate change is a new problem. Humanity has never faced it before. The institutions that we have, our governments, our economic institutions, even our social institutions, our religious institutions, none of them are really set up to deal with this massive global problem, which requires not by any means having to make our lives be extremely difficult, live in poverty or anything like that. We can definitely address this while retaining at least as good a life as, if not better. But the kinds of changes we have to make, the redesigning of our whole energy system and all of the ways that energy are used is just a kind of problem that we've never dealt with before. Maybe the closest thing is the economic mobilization that we had on the home front for World War II, where there was tens of millions of people went to work designing the things and building the things that were needed for the war effort. And in many ways, it was the war itself was terribly destructive, but the economic development process that was used created more jobs and better jobs and more security than Americans had ever known. And we could actually have a solution to climate change that was like that, but it requires a kind of cooperation, a kind of mobilization, a kind of change in our institutions that we just don't know a lot about how to do. And so the process of making the changes that are really needed, people are told, well, turn off your light bulbs or get a expensive, fancy electric car. And they think about that and they know that that's not an easy solution for them personally, that other people are unlikely to do it. And the real things that we need to do, which are basically make a transition from fossil fuel run society and economy to a climate safe, fossil free economy and society, we can do it, but we don't really have the social experience and the political clout to overcome the small number of institutions that would lose by it, namely the fossil fuel companies. So all of that leads people to say, geez, I just can't see how we would do this. I don't see how we'll get the power to do it. I don't see how we'll get people together. And I don't see how we'll make the kinds of changes we need to make. But there's another very important aspect of climate despair, which is what we might call induced despair. The fossil fuel industry and its political minions, who we're seeing very, very visibly in Washington, D.C. at this very moment, and their political supporters and governmental supporters and ideological supporters, these fossil fuel companies have spent tens of millions of dollars basically telling people that climate change isn't real. And then when they can't do that, saying, well, there's really nothing we can do about it. I remember when one of the top people from one of the largest fossil fuel companies, oil company in this case, was asked about climate change. And he said, oh, well, we can deal with the impacts of climate change. For example, we'll just it's going to affect agriculture. We'll just move where we grow the crops and we'll adjust to it that way. And we really don't have to worry. And fortunately, he was in a location where no one was going to ask him, oh, what about the floods? What about the storms? What about the droughts? But this kind of belief that, well, basically other kinds of denialism, not denial that it's happening, but denial that we can do anything about it or that we should do anything about it, is something that's been propagated deliberately to make us feel that there's nothing we can do.
In this book, I think you propose the notion to overcome that by organizing, by people, you know, essentially it's a grassroots effort, you know, that people themselves have more power that together than institutions that might oppose them, which is, you know, not a new idea. I think that historically there are antecedents for that that we all know about, including civil rights and many other societal changes that came about because of the strength of people's beliefs and their willingness to take action to express those beliefs. And you talk about one thing I thought was a great line is converting people from worriers to warriors. And maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the things that you propose that people can actually do to work together.
I think you've portrayed the argument and the approach of the book just right. We can learn a lot about this from other movements, from the original environmental protection movement, which made really a whole transformation in the way our society thought about, approached, and acted on the environment, with Superfunds and the Clean Water Act and Clean Air Act. It changed us from a society that was filled with poisonous air and constantly polluted water to one where we certainly still have these things, but the Love Canal type toxic contamination on a massive scale that we faced actually has been successfully challenged and rolled back to a considerable extent. As we know, there are those who at this very moment are trying to bring us back to that kind of polluted water, air, and land. But that doesn't prove that the original struggle wasn't effective. And obviously, we could talk about civil rights. We could talk about many, many historic examples. One of the ways in which we're disempowered and made vulnerable to climate despair is that most of us we might have picked up a little bit of it along the way, but our kids don't learn it in school. We never see it represented on media, with rare exceptions. And so the real cases where people are powerful by getting together is often not part of our shared memory. So I think actually educating ourselves and our kids about that history is one of the things that empowers us to deal with new problems like the problem of climate change. In terms of the, what people can do, as I said before, there used to be an awful lot of turn off the light bulb, buy an expensive, fancy electric car. And I think one of the big advances we've made in our understanding is those are things people, we are going to need to do electric cars. If we're going to do it, we need to have to figure out how they can be affordable for ordinary people. We do need to turn out light bulbs when we leave the room, but that's going to be a very, very small part, and it's meaningless unless it's part of a broader transformation of how we use energy that allows us to be much, much more effective in the way we use the energy that we create, as well as, of course, switching to renewable forms of energy away from fossil fuel energy. But mostly these are not, these are things that individuals, as I think you said, David, can make a tremendous contribution to, not primarily by changing their lifestyles, but by participating in a collective movement to make the real changes we need to change our energy system, our fossil fuel use. And the keys to that are, of course, it has a lot of aspects, but to my way of thinking, there are two crucial things we need to do. One is we need to stop creating new fossil fuel infrastructure. And really the things that the climate movement has been doing with the fight against pipelines and the fight against new power plants, and the fight against fracking, these are a crucial part of forcing the transition to a climate-safe economy. And the reason for that, which I find pretty hopeful, is that the existing infrastructure for our fossil fuel system represents, it's a lot of it's aging. A lot of it has to go offline every year and every decade. And actually, all of it that now exists will have to go offline because its useful life will be done around 2050, which is the point at which the climate scientists tell us we have to have completed the transition from fossil fuel to climate-safe energy. So if we just don't build any more infrastructure that uses fossil fuel, we're well on our way to phasing out the threat to the climate. Good to close down the ones that are already built too, but I think the core of it can be not that we have to shut everything down immediately and, as they say, shiver in the dark, but we can start we can immediately stop building any new fossil fuel infrastructure, and all the money that we would be investing in that, we should be investing in the transition to climate safe energy. And of course, we've had a tremendous change in the last few years to the point that the renewable energy, especially solar and wind, is now in many, many places, if not most places, as cheap or cheaper than fossil fuel infrastructure and energy. It doesn't need any raw materials dug out of the ground and shipped in pipelines. And the reason for building any new fossil fuel infrastructure is very, very hard to grasp. It destroys local environments, poisons people, and gives them asthma and other diseases. It destroys the global environment, the climate, and it's just as or more expensive. So it's wacky to build any new fossil fuel infrastructure. But the thing that needs to go along with what's sometimes called a fossil freeze, a halt to all new fossil fuel infrastructure, is the plan for how we're going to meet our needs and see that we don't shiver in the dark by means of creating that new alternative energy system that we need. I just saw today an article saying that we are now producing 10% of the energy that we use in the United States by fossil-free energy, mostly solar and wind, but also some energy and geothermal and so on. So that's a start. A few years ago, it was only, 2, 3, 4, 5%. It's growing extremely fast. There are now more jobs in the solar industry than in the coal industry. And so the way to create more jobs is clearly by making this transition to fossil free energy. But we need to plan to do it. And what I've been advocating is that we need a plan. There's, of course, many, many climate action plans that governments have at every level, that corporations have, that schools and universities have. Some of them are actually plans to move to completely fossil-free energy on the kind of timescale we need. Portland, Oregon just established a climate action plan to be 100% fossil free by 2050. And we can't all move to Portlandia, but we can do that in our own schools and universities and cities and states. And that can be the basis for making this national and showing that the Trump administration and others who are claiming that this is a terrible disaster for jobs and for people and, it's a terrible disaster for the fossil fuel industries, for just about everyone and every institution other than them. It's not a disaster. It is a tremendous opportunity for a better life while we're protecting the climate.
That's one of the things I thought was worthy of some discussion, and that is this notion that in the face of institutional resistance, especially where a narrow band of institutional power has really taken control over the national political discourse, that in fact, the grassroots from the ground up approach, utilizing this principle that you highlighted, the public trust notion, seems really a powerful idea. And that is that in states like California, New York, many others, there is a large population, a majority of people are willing and able to make change on a local and statewide level. So why not instead of beating your head against the wall trying to move a force that can't be moved, walk around them. Use a Taoist principle that water, just follow the water, not the money.
Right. I think that's exactly right. I think we are going to have a national and, in fact, a global climate action plan in order to actually, beat climate change to the ground, so to speak. It's a global problem. It's going to have to be addressed globally. There are things that really need to be done nationally. For example, if you're going to create a new electrical power grid, that's something that has to be coordinated nationally. If you're going to create a new transportation system that's based on public transportation, as well as solar vehicles, and creates some, creates a new train system that's able to cut back very, very heavily on airplanes. All of those things are going to take national coordination and national investment. But that just as important are the things that we can do locally and regionally and statewide. And we can do those things right now, and we can prove the validity and the practicality of climate-safe energy transition right now, right in our own backyards and communities and states.
One other thing that you talked about that I thought was really, I think we've been beginning to hear about, and this is this idea that a bunch of kids have sued the federal government for its failure to ensure the health and well-being of the physical world, and that is a responsibility that government has by nature. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about that, because I think not enough people know about this. I think it's a really powerful analysis, a powerful political understanding, but also a practical action that utilizes existing systems, to create a new reality.
Absolutely. And it's a fascinating story and an inspirational one. And it's very dynamic right now. So there is a very ancient doctrine, which in American law is known as the public trust doctrine. It goes back to the laws codified by the Roman Emperor Justinian, the Justinian Code, which says that the air and the ocean and the shore of the ocean belong to the people, and that everyone has a right to access to them. And the governments do not own these resources. They only serve as the trustees for the people. And this is a fundamental principle of many, many legal systems around the world, and is part of the American common law, underlies our constitutional law, is usually applied to the shores of lakes and rivers and the ocean. And a few years ago, a brilliant lawyer, a law professor named Mary Kristen Woods, despairing of the existing way that laws were being used. Environmental law was basically being used to give permits for every kind of environmental destruction that you could imagine, said, let's challenge this on the basis of the public trust doctrine. And then some other extremely creative and dedicated people said, okay, lawyers said, we'll bring the suits. Who are going to be the plaintiffs? And 21 people between about the ages of 10 and 21, in other words, kids, stepped forward to be the plaintiffs in cases which challenged every state in the United States and the federal government for failing to meet their responsibilities under the public trust doctrine. This was regarded as a kind of wacko. I remember one environmental lawyer who called it a Hail Mary pass. And I remember argument court by lawyers against it in court, saying the court can no more. This is a child's dream, a child's wish for a better world. Well, the our children's trust and the suits, which go by Giuliani versus United States, have been going forward, and the courts have been hearing them, and the most amazing progress. Some state courts have ruled in their favor and required state environmental agencies and state governments to begin the climate protection measures that these suits have called for. And a few days after Donald Trump was elected, a federal judge in Oregon, Judge Aiken, ruled that there is a public trust obligation for the United States government to protect the climate and to prevent climate destruction through climate harmful policies. This is totally remarkable. It was based, and it was the first federal court, I think, to do that. It did more than that. She did something that really went beyond what I think any of us even conceived, which is she said there the government has an obligation, but also individual persons, citizens, people have a constitutional right to as she put it, a stable climate. You see that this underlies any kind of secure government, and it is guaranteed by the right to life and liberty of the Fifth Amendment. So we can now say there is a constitutional right declared by a federal judge to a secure, stable climate system, and a public trust obligation on the part of the government to enforce the public trust against the destruction of the climate by private interests. The court case was known. It's Giuliani versus United States. It was brought under when the Obama administration was there, and so it was known as Giuliani versus Obama because Obama was the lead plaintiff. The lead defendant. And it is now known colloquially as Kids versus Trump because he is now the lead defendant.
Well, this is going to be something I think people are going to want to follow very closely. I think there's one more thing I wanted to ask you about in this book. And it is amazing that it is such a short book, but there's so much going on here that's really valuable, I think. You talk about two scenarios kind of imagining the future, you know, one being fairly grim, and that is if we pay no attention and just keep on going the way we're going, we have collapse and kind of, you know, climate-based mayhem. And the other version that you propose is that if we start really seriously working on changing now, we can have a, you know, a much different kind of future. And I suspect that it isn't quite either or. I suspect that, you know, the effects of climate change are inevitably going to cause damage to society and life, you know, human life as well as other species, regardless of what we do, even if we started right away, just because there's so much runoff period to the carbon that we've put into the atmosphere so far. But do you think it's better to imagine a future that is, well, I don't know, maybe I'm not figuring out how I want to ask this question, but do you think that it makes it do you think it's necessary to talk about the future in more apocryphal ways in order to get people interested? Or is it better to talk about the value, the optimistic value of positive change? Because I think there is a tendency for a lot of people to get, you know, maybe it's connected to that idea of climate despair, that there is this kind of disaster mongering. You see it in movies that are made that express the popular culture. In a lot of ways, we are imagining disaster every day. And that helps undermine the ability to make change.
My feeling is that it is essential to tell the truth about what the effects of climate change are and will be. And that to pretty it up or say, oh, well, you know, if we just turn off the light bulbs and drive the electric cars, we're going to be all right, and so let's all do it. I think people go directly from climate denialism in many cases to climate despair with no place in between. I think that what we need to do is both make clear what the reality is that we're facing and at the same time challenge the idea that we can't do anything about it. And that's why I end with the two scenarios, because you can see that the scenario of do nothing, or as it's sometimes called, business as usual, is truly catastrophic in our lifetimes and beyond that, more whatever catastrophic squared for our posterity. And at the same time, you can see that there is a plausible course that will, as you say, it's not going to stop climate change and reverse it because a great deal of climate change is already in the pipeline. If we hadn't been incredibly unwise, to put it in a kind way, 25 years ago when it became completely clear what was going to happen if we didn't address climate change, then we could have had a taper down that would have meant that the effects would have been relatively mild. Now we are heading for disastrous effects no matter what we do, but there's disasters and disasters, and the difference between dynamite bomb and a nuclear bomb is certainly enough of a difference that you could say, let's get rid of the nuclear bombs and not use them on ourselves. And similarly, we're not going to be able to completely halt climate change, but the difference between the reduction that we could make if we got serious about it now and what's going to happen if we don't is huge, even in our lifetimes and certainly for our kids and their kids. So I think that being realistic on both sides, I don't think it's realistic to say we can't do anything about it. I think that's just as false as saying, nothing really that bad is going to happen. What I think we need to do is see that there are two roads, as I put it in the book, two scenarios. One of them is our warning of what's going to happen and the devastating effects of not taking effective measures. And the other is the scenario that starts out looking a lot the same, but as time goes on between now and 2050, if we make the changes we need to make, we will in fact be able to come at least close to staying within the limits that scientists have said will make it possible for us to avoid the kind of thing that will devastate civilization, devastate human life. It'll still be a lot of big problems, problems. It's like the difference between a controlled disease and an uncontrolled disease. We'll be able to make it be something that we can live with.
Well, that is a perfect ending point, and I really appreciate your talking to me about this book. And it is actually, the title is completely apropos of what you just said. It's called Against Doom, A Climate Insurgency Manual. I've been talking to Jeremy Brecker. This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. Thank you.
Thank you.